your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
This happened at the beginning of my medical career. Before starting as a child specialist, I worked as a trainee and assisted many senior doctors. With my skill and credibility, I was rising the ladder of this profession while getting the chance to help kids at the same time. The one I was working under back then offered free checkups to many foster homes. The foster parents weren't all necessarily rich folks, so my senior was like a god for some of them. Going to these foster houses and providing free checkups to these kids was our way of giving back to society. I've seen all types of kids living under foster care, coming from abusive and careless households. But this one particular incident surpasses them all. Two blocks away from my apartment lived Mr. and Mrs. Kinski, who ran a foster home with five children. They were an elderly couple who couldn't have children of their own, so they decided to give these helpless kids a home. I adored them for their polite nature and how they raised these kids. All five kids were toddlers, but I've never seen such well-behaved children before. Sometimes it felt weird how excessively disciplined these kids were. They ate without complaint, talked in low voices, never fought among themselves, and all of them were very shy to strangers. Every month we used to do their checkups, and they never had any health issues. Similarly, one day we went running our monthly checkup when I saw a new kid in the house. A sweet little girl sat on the couch with the other kids. But she was different. Her eyes were always wide in anxiety, and she fidgeted a lot. Mrs. Kinski said, "Poor child. She just came yesterday. It's hard to adjust to new surroundings for some foster kids. We are trying our best to get her all settled in." After finishing the checkup, we went home, but the image of this scared little girl remained in my mind the entire day. A week went by, and I almost forgot about her when Mr. Kinski called me. Seeing his name flashing on the screen, I picked up immediately. "Hello, Mr. Kinski. How are you?"
"Robin, there has been a small incident here."
"Why? What happened?"
"Kathy, I mean the new kid. She fell from the stairs and hit her head badly. Can you please come and take a look at her?"
"Oh, no. Sure, I'm on my way." I hopped inside the car and drove straight to the Kipski residence. Mrs. Kipski opened the door and let me in. She took me to a small bedroom where I saw the girl lying on the bed with a bandage on her head. I sat next to her and asked, "Hey, how are you feeling?"
"I feel dizzy."
"Don't worry, you'll get better soon. What's your name?"
"Daisy."
I checked her pulse and gave her some medicine. She didn't lose much blood and the wound was very minimal. I told the Kipskis there's nothing to worry about. I waved goodbye to Daisy and came home. The next day, I called Mr. Kipski to check Daisy's health, and what they told me shocked me to the core. They said Daisy had been hospitalized as she went into a coma around midnight. When Mrs. Kipski went to wake her up in the morning, she realized even though Daisy was breathing, she wasn't responding to Mrs. Kipski's voice. I rushed to the hospital because obviously as a doctor, I should have anticipated a patient that was prone to going into a coma. I talked to the hospital authority and told them how she was absolutely fine when I saw her yesterday. They were shocked too, as there were no blood clots and no severe head injury. It was like she was deeply asleep and just decided not to wake up for a while. More time went by, and her condition didn't get any better. I don't know why, but Daisy's case felt so unusual to me that I decided to take an active part in bringing this innocent child back to life. I informed my senior about her, and we all set up a panel of neurosurgeons and experienced doctors to discuss Daisy's case. I visited her almost every day and kept checking her charts every night. Daisy's room became my home for a while. Foster parents, Mr. and Mrs. Kipski, regularly visited her and cried tears of pain. They requested me to get her well soon. In one word, I was devastated. It was the beginning of my career, and I was the one who talked to Daisy before she went into this unconscious state. I still remember how sweetly she pronounced her name. I blamed myself for not putting enough importance on when she said, "I feel dizzy." Even though we ran a countless number of MRIs and CT scans, we didn't get one reason that could explain why a toddler went into a coma after having a mild bump on the head. Something wasn't adding up here. But I never thought discovering the truth would change my perspective on life forever. One night, I reached the hospital quite late after attending a long day of checkups. I was walking to Daisy's room to take a look at her charts. It was 1:30 in the morning, and I was a few meters away from her room when I saw a young woman coming out of her room and walking away. I have never seen this woman before, and she was not a hospital staff member. Apart from them, no outsider is allowed to visit the patients at this hour, and Daisy is a foster kid. She has no one else to call family other than the Kipskis at this point. My presence of mind kicked in, and I called out to that woman.
"Excuse me? Who are you?"
She stopped, but didn't turn around. Till now, I hadn't seen her face clearly, but judging from her pale white gown, she felt very suspicious to me. I asked again,
"Hello? Ma'am? Are you a patient here?"
She turned her face partially and said, "I came to see my daughter." I was startled and said, "Your daughter? Who is your daughter?" She lifted her frail, bony hand and pointed to Daisy's room. Oh my God, she's Daisy's mom? I had no idea something like this could happen, so I got very embarrassed. But rules are the same for everyone, so I said, "I understand, but you can't just go into her room at these late hours. And if you are so worried for her, why did you let her go into foster care? Thank God the Kipskis are here for her." All this time as I spoke, she didn't turn to me once. But as soon as I mentioned the Kipskis' name, she looked back in one go. Her face was disturbingly pale, like she had no blood in her veins. She not only looked anemic, but excessively sick as well. She said, "Please, let me take her away with me. They are torturing them. I can't see her getting abused like that." "What? What are you saying? Abuse?" "You should check the room under the Kipskis' house. Then you'll know what they do to these kids. Daisy has one more day. If they don't get caught, I'll take her away with me."
I was about to ask her more questions when a nurse called my name and I looked over to her. She was surprised to see me. By the time I looked back, that woman was gone. It was as if she'd vanished into thin air. What happened next was beyond anyone's imagination. I went to the cops and told them to check the basement of the Kipskis' house, saying I think they abuse the kids. I had no idea if they would find anything, but something in me told me to go with my gut. I couldn't just shake off whatever that woman said. If she is Daisy's mother, then I should give her the chance. The cops raided their house without any notice and found lots of footage of where these kids were forced to do obscene things in front of the camera. It left no doubt that this elderly couple was earning money by doing these heinous crimes. They got arrested immediately and charged with the maximum punishment, even though they deserved way more than that. But the story doesn't end here. Surprisingly, Daisy woke up from her coma the day Mr. and Mrs. Kipski got sentenced to prison. And when I inquired about her mother, I came to know she died after suffering from long-term cancer. And this is the only reason why Daisy landed in foster care. She had no one else but her mother. It still gives me goosebumps to think how even after death, her mother came back to take Daisy with her that night. She just wanted to rescue her poor child from the grasp of evil foster parents, and for that, she had only one way left: showering her daughter with eternal sleep. I suffer from intense claustrophobia, and this isn't something I was born with in the first place. This anxiety disorder has taken shape from childhood trauma. When I was 7 years old, a passerby found me in a garbage bin. He was walking when he heard a cry of an infant. That man was kind enough to rescue me from the dumpster and take me to the police station. It seemed like my birth parents wanted nothing to do with me, so they dumped me, just like a piece of garbage.
The policeman was shocked how I even survived lying in a pile of filthy trash without getting noticed by hungry stray dogs or some other wild animal. The answer was simple to me. Animals are way better than humans. And as I went on with my life, this belief became stronger and more evident day by day. Eventually, I became a ward of the state after being rescued. I got shifted into a foster home as soon as I turned 6, and that's where everything that I'm about to tell you happened. The foster home was run by a shrewd man named Mr. Parson. Apart from me, there were 2 other kids about my age, Camilla and Jensen. The house we lived in was a 2-story wooden house with a strong smell of cigars churning in the air 24/7. Mr. Parson smoked a lot, but that wasn't the only problem. The main problem was much bigger than that. Mr. Parson was a man of foul nature, cruel behavior, and obscene habits. In one word, he was hell for any foster kid. But in this foster care system, the number of kids in need was increasing like the number of stray dogs. The locality we lived in wasn't an ideal place for a child to grow up either. But the truth is, it was either living under a roof or living in the streets. Many times, when authorities sent a child to foster care, they failed to follow up on the matter. Maybe not all the time, but certainly in my case. And that's why we 3 kids had the worst foster care experience that any kid should ever go through. Generally, we were given to wear old, tattered clothes, but when the authorities visited once in a while to make a quick check, Mr. Parson prepared us like happy, clean kids that he was raising as his own. He gave us mostly canned foods that he never bothered to check if they were expired or not. I remember Camilla vomiting right on the table after having a spoonful of rotten canned tuna. He forced us to do all the household chores. I remember getting such sore hands after scrubbing the entire wooden floor of the house. We wanted to get out of there, but we had nowhere to go. No neighbor even bothered to check on us. Apart from all this torture, he also used to punish us whenever we didn't go by his rules or did something wrong, according to him. One night after dinner, he told me to wash all the plates while he sat in the living room watching a football game. I accidentally slipped and broke one plate and also my nose after hitting the hard floor. What he did next gave birth to my fear of closed spaces. He put a dog leash on me and made me crawl into a cupboard like a dog and locked me inside. I could see the lights entering the dark cupboard from the blinds, and I probably cried myself to sleep that night. The next morning, when he finally let me out, I rushed to Camilla and Jensen, as they were my only family at that point. Mr. Parson went to buy groceries like a proud dictator after putting us kids through misery. That was the first time when Camilla said, "We need to get out of here." We 3 sat down and started to discuss what we can do to get ourselves out of this hellhound's torture. Every Saturday night, Mr. Parson used to have a woman over whose name was Lucy. I didn't get it then, but I can tell you now that Lucy worked as a call girl. She used to wear animal print clothes with very loud makeup and a weird white wig to present herself as a blondie. We never saw her actual hair color until one time. So whenever Lucy came to the house, Mr. Parson used to get drunk with her, play loud music, and then, after a certain point, do their business in his room. We thought it would be the perfect time to run away from the house and go to the police to describe our situation. Because all the other times, Mr. Parson locked the main door with a key, and all the windows were shut down so that our noises never got out. Not just that, he watched us like a vulture. He inspected every move we made, and if he felt we were trying to outsmart him, he always said in a creepy voice,
"I can see you."
But enough was enough, and we had to do something. Every night after dinner, we slowly prepared ourselves for the coming Saturday. It was our do-or-die situation. I was very much aware that if we failed and got caught, he would do terrible and painful things to us. Like one time when Jensen tried to sneak out from an open window, he dragged him in and made him sleep with the dead rats in the attic. Jensen said the smell up there was more awful than anyone could ever imagine. When Saturday came, we all braced ourselves. We tried to do everything neatly so that Mr. Parson wouldn't get the chance to lock any of us up, because that would ruin the plan. We cleaned the house, polished his shoes, made the bed for him and Lucy.
Around 8 p.m., the doorbell rang, and he rushed to answer it. Being overly dressed with that same monstrous look, Lucy came inside. We three stood in the living room like slaves to serve her and follow every order she gave. She sat down on the couch and said,
"Bring me a chilled beer from the fridge, you little pigs."
I ran and did as she said. Mr. Parsons sat beside her, and they started to flirt with each other like usual. Camilla looked at Jensen and said in a low voice,
"Pick up the key from the table before he takes it to his room."
Jensen slowly walked to it and picked it up before he could notice. The night went by, and they had dinner and lots of alcohol. Around 2 a.m., they finally went inside his bedroom to do you know what, and we got the chance to escape from this doom of torture. As soon as we heard Mr. Parsons' bedroom door close, we came out of our room and tiptoed to the main door. Jensen was about to enter the key into the keyhole when Lucy came out suddenly and screamed,
"Oh my God, these little pigs are escaping!"
She came running at Jensen to snatch the key away when I jumped on her back, grabbing her wig with one hand and scratching her face with my dirty, sharp nails of the other hand. Some of her skin came off along with blood and she screamed louder than ever. Mr. Parsons was probably getting his pants on, which gave us some more time, and Jensen managed to open the door. Camilla and Jensen went out, and I was about to take my first step, leaving Lucy on the floor writhing in pain, holding her face, when a tough hand grabbed me from behind and pulled me in, saying,
"You're not going anywhere!"
The door of hope shut in front of my eyes as I saw Camilla and Jensen running away. What happened next was like a nightmare that carried on for a never-ending 72 hours. Even though Jensen and Camilla managed to find the nearest police station, out of shock and trauma, they both fainted when they reached there. The cops took them to the hospital, where both of them got diagnosed with severe mental trauma, physical deficiencies, low blood pressure, and malnourishment. After 2 days, when they were finally able to talk and explain the proper situation, being two little six-year-olds, all they could say was,
"This scary house with the scary man who has Jamie."
The cops asked them repeatedly where this house was, but they couldn't give proper direction in words. The cops asked the hospital authority if they could take the kids with them so that they could show them this house, but seeing their poor health condition, the hospital authority told them to wait a day more. On the third day, around 7:30 p.m., the cops finally rang the doorbell of Mr. Parsons' house, taking Camilla with them. Surprisingly, Mr. Parsons thought Camilla and Jensen had just run away. He never thought they would bring the cops to rescue me from his grasp. Mr. Parsons tried to lie to the cops, saying these kids ran away on their own and how he never had any other kid except these two. Thank God the cops didn't believe him. They searched the entire house and finally found me in the filthy attic, being highly dehydrated for 3 days and locked inside a wooden trunk, covered with bruises, and just like another dead rat. I was covered in my own piss and smelling like that dumpster from where I was rescued the first time. Mr. Parsons was sent to prison under charges of child abuse, abduction, and neglect. Lucy was also sentenced to prison for contributing to Mr. Parsons' evil deeds. I had to undergo therapy to overcome claustrophobia. I still wake up screaming at night, seeing myself locked up in a dark space where no matter how loud my screams, no one can hear them.